Every time a new Apple product is rumored or actually comes out, a fraction of the country goes into a frenzy. Every bit of new information is pored over by millions of Apple cultists. A new release is getting that kind of excitement right now, but it's an old-fashioned book, a huge tell-all biography of Steve Jobs. Jobs was known for being super secretive, but when he knew he was very ill, he gave the writer Walter Isaacson complete and total access. The book came out Monday, and it is already the number one bestseller on Amazon, and Walter Isaacson is here with me now. Walter, welcome to Studio 360.
It's great to be with you, Kurt.
So, you said no to Steve Jobs at first when he asked you to do this some years ago, and then you said no again.
Well, that makes it sound like I'm, denying Steve Jobs.
It was a
casual conversation in summer of 2004 in which he says, you know, you ought to write my biography. And I said to him, hey, you're a young guy. You've been a whole career ahead of you. We'll do it in a couple of decades when you finally retire. And it didn't quite occur to me that he had just been diagnosed with cancer. And he hadn't told me that. And so by the time I fully realized the seriousness of his cancer, and he had done, you know, by 2009 when we started talking seriously again, you know, the iPod, the iPad, the iPhone, and totally transformed three more industries, I thought, boy, this guy stands right at the connection of creativity and technology, and he's fighting cancer, and he wants to talk. You know, of course I wanted to do it.
But the thing that shocked me the most, I think, about this book is what a jerk he was. I mean, what a cruel, callous, unkind person he was.
He was callous and unkind quite a bit. And I try to, I hope, also put that in perspective, which is, why is he that way? And, you know, his explanations are, you got to prevent the bozo explosion in any company. Secondly, if you're brutally honest, you're going to get A players. He said, look, I'm sure in the Brahmin clubs there's a more velvet-gloved way of doing it. But people, I say, you know, who wear these velvet gloves often don't make a dent in the universe. And he said, and I'm not that person. This is who I am. You have to look at the result. Let me try to put it in context, and I hope the book does this. Professionally, he can be really rough on people or canonize them and put them on a pedestal. So what happens? In two different places, Pixar and Apple, he creates a team that not only is filled with A players, it's not what he says, you know, saturated with the bozo explosion, meaning mediocre players in the middle level. It's all A players. And more importantly, he pulls together a team at Apple and at Pixar who are phenomenally loyal. You could pick other companies where people run it with velvet gloves and people are always nice. They don't have people who stick around and are loyal.
Because it was in the service of the insanely great.
It was in the service of the insanely great. He was very charismatic. And let me even put it to the family then. When, you know, the end comes last month, a month or two ago, and it's, you know, he's very ill. All four of his children are there right by his bedside all the time, totally adoring him. His wife, a faithful, you know, relationship for more than 20 years, she's there totally adoring him. His sister, Mona Simpson. So who am I to judge?
The net result at the pearly gates is, more good than bad.
The net result at the pearly gates is he's a genius, and he was charismatic, and he sure rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. But in the end, he created great products, a great team, and a great family, all of whom were insanely loyal to him.
One of the interesting motifs in this book that we learn that is implicit in knowing the products, but here you learn one learns the specifics of it, is his interest, his sort of self-taught, really, interest in design from the beginning. Yeah. At Reed College, he takes a calligraphy course, and that inspires his interest in typography, which makes the Macintosh typographical look what it was.
It starts when he's a little kid, and he's growing up in a housing suburb filled with these homes called Eichler homes, Joseph Eichler, E-I-C-H-L-E-R. And he made mass-marketed homes that were sort of like Frank Lloyd Wright homes, but they were done inexpensively for the masses. But they had, you know, sort of big windows and extreme simplicity. And Steve Jobs appreciated the notion not only of great design, but taking great design and making it for the masses. Likewise, his father taught him when they built a fence around the backyard of that house, make sure the back of the fence is just as good looking as the front. Because even though nobody will see it, you will know. And you will know that you put as much care into the parts unseen as you did to the parts seen. Then, you know, when he's first starting Apple, even in the garage, he goes to a little Sony, you know, showroom, and he's looking at the brochures and loves the industrial Sony style. Then he goes to the Aspen Design Conference in the late 1970s, and he realizes, and he gives a talk. I found a cassette tape of it in one of the archives there, in which he says, I used to love the Sony industrial design where you slap black on it and it feels heavy and industrial, black, black, black. But now that I've seen the Bauhaus style, which is, you know, the style of the 1930s out of Germany, Herbert Beyer and Gropius and Mies van der Rohe and others, I understand the virtue of simplicity, of keeping it clean. And simplicity is not something shallow, just a veneer where you eliminate things. Simplicity means you truly grok, you truly get the depth of the complexity that you have to overcome, and then you're able to make it simple. So that becomes the foundation of the Apple style.
And he talks about that again and again in different ways, and you find to you and you find him in the past talking about, oh, Michelangelo and Da Vinci were not just great artists, they were great scientists, and having these presentations where he says, we got to be at the intersection of Technology Street and Liberal Arts Street.
Right, exactly. And almost all the slides for the iPod up at the end, I mean, his presentations end with a picture of the intersection of Liberal Arts Street and Technology Street. It comes from when he was a really young and he met Edwin Land of Polaroid, you know, back when Steve was first starting Apple. And Land says to him, the place to be is at the intersection of the humanities and technology. And I actually think that's, I hope, a lesson people can draw from the book, which is in the 21st century in this country, we've always had, you know, great technology and we've always had innovation. If we're going to be the preeminent, you know, or any society is going to be a driving economy in the 21st century, it's going to be not just because you're good at science and math and technology, but you're good at connecting that to the arts and the humanities, creativity, design.
With artists like John Lasseter, like the
Johnny Ive, the great designer.
Exactly. The great designer he hired before that at Next to design just his logo, Paul Rand, paid him $100,000 for just a logo. It seems as though his contempt or tendency toward contempt didn't extend to artists. He cut them a lot more slack.
Yeah, as I said, there's that hero bozo divide in his life. You're either one or the other. And if you were an artist, he truly had this emotional. I mean, he would get tears in his eyes. And by artists, I mean, you know, copywriters for the ads. If the copywriting was great, he would tear up and say, it's the best thing I've ever seen. And so, I hope in the book when people see him berating people who do things bad, there is an equal number of him tearing up and saying, this is just the most beautiful ad copy, the most beautiful design of an iPod. This is the most beautiful movie.
Well, and there's a sense that they are authored, you know, that it isn't just a series of compromises to do it cheaply. It's there is an intelligence behind them.
The original Macintosh, after he's driving everybody insane for what he calls an insanely great product, and he's doing his reality distortion field, meaning we can have it out this January when they're saying, no, we can't. He calls them all together and he says, great artists, sign their work. I want you to sign. And they have a big, you know, sheet that they all take Sharpies and sign, and it's engraved on the inside cover of the original Mac. Now, they made the original Mac with the type of fasteners that you couldn't even open up. I mean, there's no screws allowing you to open up the Mac. Nobody will see that, but he wanted to know that the 20, 30 members of the original Macintosh team were artists and that they should sign the inside of the case.
His perfectionism about design and his and the way he could be so contemptuous of bad design even extended to the medical devices he was
so he's lying with. There in Memphis, 2009, having had a liver transplant. They put an oxygen mask on him, or mask on him. I'm not sure it's just some sort of mask. And he's kind of groggy, and he's really, you know, sedated. And he says, I hate the design of this. And he rips it off. And he orders them, you know, the nurses and doctors, whatever, bring me five different options, because that's what he always loved to do in the design studio with Johnny Ive, is walk around and say, let's look at five options for how we could do the next iPad. And then there was a medical device he had to put on his finger to measure blood oxygen, I think it was. And he hated the design of it. So actually, in the past year, he had been working on how do you create a better design for a medical device like that.
That's amazing. I also realized reading this book, which is terrific, that in a way I hadn't before, that Steve Jobs is the kind of ultimate baby boomer in every respect, for better and for worse. This hippie who kind of monetized the countercultural sensibility to become a multi-billionaire. This adult who decided, no, I'm going to wear jeans and sneakers all the time. I don't care what you business guys think. This childlike think differentness and kind of love of his devices as toys, the way a child loves something on Christmas morning. Yet this terrible brat too. I mean, he really is his generation in an incredibly vivid nutshell.
Absolutely. And what's particularly interesting, and it happens in Silicon Valley in the late 1960s and early 70s, is you have the great fusion of what becomes a baby boomer contradictions, which is on the one hand, you know, drugs, rock and roll, dropping acid, listening to Janis Joplin and the Grateful Dead and the Bay Area groups and that sort of whole earth catalog mentality. And also the startup technology, electronics geekiness that's, you know, part of the mentality back then too. And this fusion happens, and Steve Jobs is the epitome of it, which is wanting to be ambitious, successful, business-like, but also wanting to do that 1984 ad, wanting to do those Think Different ads to reassert the fact that you're a rebel, a misfit. And he wrote the copy for the Think Different ads with a few other copywriters. We kept inserting phrases. And it's, you know, here's the crazy ones, the rebels, the misfits. And this is, you know, he's writing not just about people who buy Apple products, but about himself. And I think it ends by saying something like, the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do. It is not just a manifesto for the Macintosh, but for the baby boomers and, frankly, for him.
He, like the ultimate baby boomer that he is a lover of music, especially music that came out when he was young. And you, more than once, it seems, look at all the music on his various Apple devices, and he played at one point his favorite music for you, including Joni Mitchell's Little Green, which, if listeners don't know, I want to remind them of what that song sounds like.
Born with the moon in Cancer, choose her a name she will answer to. Call her green, and the winters cannot fade her. Call her green for the children who've made her little green. Be a gypsy dancer.
So a lot of people have been moved by Joni Mitchell over the years, but why was that song so important?
Well, Little Green is actually about having a child and putting it up for adoption. And Steve was, of course, put up for adoption by his biological mother when he was born. And he played that a lot. I asked him at one point, you know, does he think a lot about having been put up for adoption now? This was near the end, you know, this recently. And we were playing that song in his living room because he had just gotten the iPad 2 and transferred all of his music. And he was complaining about iCloud not yet existing, so he couldn't sync it automatically. And he had to, you know, manually sync his new iPad 2. And he was playing that song. He said, no, you know, I think now more about legacy than about being adopted. But he loved Joni Mitchell, and of course he loved Joan Baez, who he actually went out with for a while.
I didn't realize that he had a relationship with his other hero, Bob Dylan's former girlfriend, Joan Baez, who was 14 years older than he. Speaking of Dylan, who was, again, as with the, you know, it's a plurality, if not a majority of baby boomers, was his absolute hero. His favorite Dylan song, you say, was One Too Many Mornings?
That's what he said. I actually also think that there are a couple of other songs he loved from Dylan. When he does the Macintosh, the original Macintosh, he quotes from Bob Dylan lyrics.
Good morning and welcome to Apple's 1984 annual shareholders meeting. I'd like to open the meeting with a part of an old poem, about a 20-year-old poem by Dylan. That's Bob Dylan. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pens, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times, they are a-changing.
He knew that this wasn't going to be a hagiography. But it's one thing to theoretically say, yes, I want it, the unvarnished truth. This won't seem like a house job, authorized biography. But it's another thing to see it. He didn't read it, right, before he died.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If he'd read it, do you think he would be angry?
Yeah, he said in our last meeting, you know, a couple months ago when I was at his house and he was ill, he said, there'll be parts of this book I won't like. And it was a little bit more of a question than just a statement. I laughed and said, yeah, you know, I'm sure of that. And he said, don't worry, I'm not going to read it when it comes out. I'll read it a year from now or so, if I'm, you know, still around. But he said it in a way that I'll read it a year from now, and it made me believe he was going to be around a year from now, which actually made me very happy because he had this way of infusing people around him with his belief, his optimism. And by the way, he had had 7 years of miracles, so okay, he'll stay one lily pad ahead of the cancer again for another year. And so I really believe that. I was hoping, it was of course hoping, that he was going to be around when it came out, and I was braced for the fact that he'd be yelling at me about certain things, but I kind of relished it. Relishing in that sort of painful way, you relish something that's going to be so interesting and so intense, but yeah, like also a little bit painful, like a roller coaster ride. I was, you know, bracing for the talks we would have afterward.
Walter Isaacson, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Kurt.
Oh, I know I'll never lose affection for people and things that went before. Stop and think about them. In my life, I love you more.
Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs is out now.
In my life, I love you more.